seminar. My name is Jean Balance. I come to you from the EPA's Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division, where I'll be serving as the online moderator. In just a few seconds, I'm going to go ahead and pull up a presentation deck and walk everybody through a series of instructions on how you can join us for today's broadcast. For those of you that have already made it into our online Adobe room, I just want to draw your attention to the live interactive poll that you should see in the lower left portion of your screen. That poll is going to ask you to identify your affiliation. Simply click on the circle to the left of the answer that best matches your affiliation, and that will privately submit your answer. You may need to scroll up and down, but it will really help both our instructors as well as our other participants understand our audience for today's live broadcast. We're here to kick off the Renewable Energy Projects on Federal Land seminar that will explore practical guidance and site examples. Today's seminar has been sponsored by the EPA's Repowering America's Land Initiative. Our live broadcast is scheduled to run from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern. We'll be joined by a number of presenters today, and I'm going to turn things over to Adam Klinger in just a few moments to introduce those speakers. But before we do so, I want to make sure everybody's comfortable with joining us for the live broadcast today. When you registered for today's seminar, you would have received an email that would have had a complete set of instructions on how to join us for the live broadcast. That email would have sent you to something called the seminar homepage, which had a complete agenda for today's session, bios and contact information for all of our speakers, links to download the slides, and most importantly, a big button on the upper left corner that says Go to Seminar. If you click that button, you'll be asked to enter your first and last name, and you'll be able to join us for the live broadcast online. Once you've joined us online, we're going to be using a very interactive tool called Adobe Connect. You'll be able to watch in real time as our presenters deliver their various talks from their locations. So this entire session will be fully interactive. You can actually sit back and watch as they deliver the session. If you're having any problems with that Adobe Connect broadcast, though, the complete set of presentation materials are available to download from the seminar homepage. If you prefer to take notes or flip back and forth for your own reference, again, I'd encourage you to download copies of the presentation materials from the seminar homepage. Audio will be available by default for all participants through Adobe Connect. You can actually listen to the entire broadcast right through your computer or mobile device. If you're having any problems with that online audio, I'd first encourage you to check your local volume settings on your speaker or computer. Sometimes you simply need to boost your speaker output. If that doesn't work, we do have toll-free call-in information that we'll be happy to share with anyone who needs it. Simply give us a note in the Q&A window in the lower right corner, and I'll be happy to share that call-in number. If you do join us on the phone, though, please note all telephone lines will be globally muted, and we would ask you to remain on that global mute to help cut down on background noises. We will have designated breaks throughout today's broadcast where we'll take live questions from our audience. However, you can submit your questions, comments, or report technical difficulties at any time using the Q&A pod or window that's located in the lower right corner of your screen. To enter those questions or comments, simply click your cursor on the thin white field or bottom box, and you can start typing into that window. When you're done, hit enter or press the cartoon bubble to the right, and that'll privately submit your comments and questions. And then we'll hold them in the queue until we take the designated breaks. You can enter them at any time. If you want to test it out, go right ahead. It's a private submission, so no one else will be able to read your questions or comments except for the moderators. Today's session is being recorded and will be available for free replay from the CLUIN website in approximately 1 to 2 weeks. You'll automatically get an email once that archive is available to share. If you like what you're seeing here today on CLUIN, we do offer these types of seminars throughout each week, and we have well over 500 previously recorded sessions that are available for free replay right now. So again, the majority of your screen in just a moment is going to be occupied by a PowerPoint presentation that will change automatically. You'll have a button to make the slides larger if you want. It says full screen in the upper right corner of that window. You can click that and make the slides bigger. You'll see logos for the sponsors who are providing talks change throughout today's session. You'll see a collection of related URLs. These are active hyperlinks. You can click on any one of those to pull them up locally on your own computer. And then, of course, the Q&A window in the lower right corner where you can submit your comments and questions. Press that little cartoon bubble to submit them to us. And I just want to draw everybody's attention. For those of you who have joined us, we do have that live poll just below for an affiliation spread. And Adam, from what I'm seeing, it looks like almost half of the audience is identifying themselves, about 42%, as a federal agency that's not DOD, Department of Energy, or Department of Interior. And then about a quarter of the audience is made up of consultants. And then the rest is a combination of state and local tribal renewable energy developers, as well as some others, or some of the other federal agencies. So we appreciate everybody participating in that live poll. Adam, I'm going to go ahead and pull up your slide deck, and we'll go ahead and let you officially kick off today's session.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Jean. My name again is Adam Klinger. I'm with EPA and with the Repowering America's Land Initiative. So I also wanted to welcome everyone to the webinar, and I'm very excited about our collection of topics and speakers. A little bit about the initiative. We're part of the agency's priority to return contaminated or potentially contaminated lands to productive reuse, and also part of the government's priority to encourage renewable energy development. So we bring those two ideas together. Our focus on federal lands today recognizes the many efforts underway to pursue renewable energy on such lands and for the government to be a leader in such development. You may recall earlier this summer, the president unveiled his climate action plan where he set a goal to further increase generation from renewable energy sources, to double such generation by 2020. And many agencies, in particularly the Department of Defense agencies, have ambitious goals to reduce their carbon footprint and make installations more energy self-sufficient. So we believe that renewable energy development is a great reuse opportunity for contaminated lands, many of which may have limited reuse options. And just as we know that there are thousands of potentially contaminated sites across the country, we know that there are many contaminated sites on federal lands, where we seek to encourage the consideration of such contaminated parcels in the renewable energy plans that agencies are pursuing. So to help such consideration along, we have assembled this group of people experienced in the planning and the implementation of renewable energy projects on federal land. So let me go to our agenda. So we will start out with a couple of folks from the U.S. Department of Energy's Federal Energy Management Program. Mr. Boyan Kovacic and Ms. Ann Crowley will give a presentation there. And then we have a host of speakers from the Massachusetts Military Reservation, Ms. Robe Forbes, Captain Sean Doyle, Mr. Steve Mellon, and Ms. Elizabeth Kirkpatrick. And I'll introduce them more elaborate fashion when their talks come up. And finally, from the DOE Pantex site, we have Mr. John Herrera. So let me go ahead and introduce Boyan and Ann and get the seminar started. So thanks for joining us. Boyan Kovacic is a project manager in the Office of Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy's Federal Energy Management Program in the U.S. Department of Energy. He focuses on deploying renewable energy across federal facilities, managing a renewable energy project assistance program, and the development of information resources and assessment maps and tools. He completed rotational assignments at the U.S. Department of Interior's Bureau of Land Management and the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, where he supported utility and distributed scale renewable energy projects. Prior to joining the U.S. Department of Energy in 2009, he undertook internships in the British Parliament, the United Nations, and the U.S. Department of State. Boyan received a BA in International Affairs from Northeastern University and a Master's in Political Science from George Washington University. So I'll go ahead and introduce Ann Crawley as well. They'll be sharing the duties on this first presentation. So Ann manages the Renewable Energy Technologies Program element for the Federal Energy Management Program, providing guidance, information, and technical assistance on renewable energy for federal agencies. She also manages an effort on optimum performance buildings, supporting the Department of Defense on net zero energy activities. Recently, she has worked on a large-scale renewable energy projects guide. She oversees FEMP's work on guidance and reporting for federal renewable energy, including guidance on renewable energy credits. She oversees work on cost information for distributed renewable energy technology and other information resources, as well as renewable project assistance. She also supports the Army's net zero energy efforts at 9 Army installations. Ms. Crawley received her BA in architecture at Yale University and has a master's in energy and resources from the University of California, Berkeley. So Boyan and Ann, let me turn it over to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me? I'm going to introduce it, and then Boyan will do most of the presentation. I'll just again, excuse me. So this is our guide. You heard about it in my bio. We're pleased to participate in this webinar and get the word out on it. This is a guide, as we've said, for large renewable energy projects. And it's focused on large projects over 10 megawatts that are third-party financed. It's based on a project developer's process because for privately financed projects, the developers have to compete for funding in financial markets, and that requires a process with clear steps and requirements to meet those financial requirements, which is a little more rigorous than we've been trying to do these large projects in the federal sector for a while, and everybody's sort of come at it from different ways. So this is a more methodical approach that we hope will be useful. We've also included steps that adapt that private developer's process to the federal process, which is a little different, but still, to have a project that's successful, especially if it's going to be privately financed, it has to meet those private finance requirements. So my colleague Boyan, and who's also a collaborator on this project, will give the presentation. So thank you for asking us to participate.
Boyan? Hey, thanks, man. Thanks. So I'll just dive in and start by giving a brief intro into our program. See if I can get it to move. Oh, there we go. Okay. So the Federal Energy Management Program works with key individuals to accomplish energy change within organizations by bringing expertise from all levels of project and policy implementation to enable federal agencies to meet energy-related goals and to provide energy leadership to the country. So I'm clicking, but it's not moving or advancing.
Point, you can try to use the arrow keys that are physically on the screen in the lower left corner.
I just see actually the full presentation. I don't see.
Okay, well, if you want to just, there we go.
Okay. Yeah, so all right. We'll see how it goes. So the Federal Renewable Energy Program works to increase the proportion of renewable energy in the federal government's energy mix. We provide four services to help meet this goal: web-based knowledge and tools, project assistance, interagency coordination, and guidance. Our technical assistance is organized around three different types of renewable energy projects: distributed scale projects, which are typically smaller than 10 megawatts, large-scale renewable energy projects, which are typically larger than 10 megawatts, and integrating renewables in green building construction or major renovations. Okay, so next slide. So our approach to large-scale renewable energy projects is captured in our large-scale RE guide. The guide is based on a common project development and implementation process, as reflected in the three horizontal lines on this graphic. So I don't think you can see my fortunately, I don't think you can see my mouse, but I was going to, the first line there is federal agency, the second line, oh, there we go, federal agency, developer, and financier. And I'll develop and explain the piece of this key graphic later in the presentation. Thank you. So unlike distributed scale renewable energy projects, large-scale renewable energy projects are limited to the few agencies that have the land and sometimes the load to host these projects. We see the Army, Navy, Marines, Air Force, the Department of Energy, and NASA as the main agencies in this space. Like other agencies, these six federal agencies are motivated by the federal agency renewable energy goal to consume at least 7.5% of total electricity from renewables. The new goal from the President's Climate Action Plan from June 25th to have 20% consumption of renewable electricity by 2020 and the goal to reduce greenhouse gas emissions 28% by 2020. And in particular, the Department of Defense has the ambitious goal to produce 3 gigawatts of renewables by 2025, with the Army, Navy, and Air Force each contributing 1 gigawatt. The next slide. Okay. So far, the guide has been used by 3 agencies. We've been using the guide to provide implementation support to the Department of Energy's Pantex plant wind farm that is being financed through an energy savings and performance contract. So John will tell you more about that good project. FEB has also worked closely with the Army's Energy Initiatives Task Force, which is the Army's central management office responsible for large-scale renewable energy projects. The process in our guide is a basis for the Army's internal process. As you can see, the EITF is currently supporting 4 projects. Many elements of this guide have also been incorporated by the Navy. So next slide. So the guide exists to help federal agencies develop competitive large-scale renewables projects. Since these projects are dependent on private investment, these projects must attract project developers and financiers. Agencies must therefore recognize that their projects must be competitive with other projects seeking project development and construction capital. The next slide. So to develop these competitive projects, the guide explains the federal agency, project developer, and financier's role, environment, goals, language, and process, so that each party can understand the other and see where they fit within the common process to develop a renewables project. The guide also creates a methodology in order to build strong business cases, define and mitigate risks, and establish good project characteristics. If agencies develop projects that follow this process and methodology, they should be able to issue strong competitive solicitations that should attract the interest of the most experienced project developers. Next slide. Although federal agencies and the private sector have different sub-goals, both have the primary goal of deploying significant amounts of large-scale renewable energy projects on federal lands using private investment. Next slide. Further, federal agencies and the private sector have a common process for developing large-scale renewables projects, even though their language and terms are different. You can see on the graphic that the left and middle parts of this process, right over here, seem to be broken down in stages with different names and stages that don't align. However, the work going on in these stages is mostly the same. The next slide. So this slide highlights the common difference in perspective between the project developer and the government. The developer is used to finding creative solutions and projects with private sector partners and expects to be able to apply them to federal agency projects as well. However, federal agencies don't have the same flexibility because they can only do what's authorized by law. The guide identifies these type of important differences. So next slide. So moving back to the process. Underlying the process is risk. Risk is key because large-scale renewable energy projects are highly complex and risky. The guide acknowledges 2 types of risk, project risk and investment dollars at risk. Project risk is shown on the downward sloping red line. And this risk is the most familiar. As unknowns about the project are reduced or mitigated, risks decrease. The less familiar is investment dollars at risk, which starts on this green line. The government is the initial investor in a federal agency project. Its investment dollars at risk steadily increases as the agency spends more money to develop the project without any guarantee that the project will eventually be built. Yet, when the project is based on the developer, his or her investment dollars at risk increases more rapidly because the developer is spending money in a greater amount and at a higher cost without the same guarantee. But once the project reaches financial close, this risk decreases as the asset is being constructed and stabilizes after the project becomes operational. The next slide. So the top graphic here is for reference. The focus of, well, it'd be good to click one more time. Some animation on this slide. There we go. So the top graphic is for reference over here. So the focus of both the guide and the slide is on the project development phase of a project, in part because the project developer is responsible for the construction and operations phases. You could click again. So we break the project development phase into three stages, focusing on the perspective of the federal agency and the project developer. We then organize these stages into two frameworks that guide the work being done. If you could click again. So the first is the project fundamentals framework, which assesses the market or environment for project opportunities. And the second one there is the project development framework, which assesses the characteristics of a specific project. You can advance. So starting with project fundamentals. Project fundamentals is made of five elements that determine a strong market or environment for project opportunities. The first element is baseline. Baseline gets into the purpose of the project and the characteristics of the local energy market. For example, the current fuel mix and energy demand and supply projections. Renewables do not make sense everywhere, so there should be supportive reasons for doing a large-scale project at a particular federal agency site. The second is economics, which look at which type of renewable technologies and projects could be cost-effective for an energy consumer and profitable for a developer. If a project is not economic at this stage, it will likely not improve later in project development. In that case, the agency needs to decide whether it or any other off-taker is willing to pay above market rates for electricity. The third is policy. Supportive policies such as state renewable portfolio standards can make a project, while unsupportive policies such as limitations or bans on behind-the-meter third-party power purchase agreements can kill a project. Other federal, state, and local policies typically affect the economics and risks of a project. The fourth is technology. In short, only bankable technologies should be considered, as investors do not want to take the risk created by unproven technologies. For large-scale renewable projects, the technology should be commercially available and have a good track record. In addition, the agency should be considering only one or sometimes two realistic renewable resources per site and at least have a preliminary assessment of the renewable resource. The fifth is consensus, which is internal to the agency. After analyzing the first four elements, the agency should identify the opportunities with the strongest fundamentals and then agree to support only those renewable opportunities. After this stage of a project, the agency will have to make an even greater investment in the development of specific projects. Further, more players will start to be involved in the project. Consensus is therefore critical to ensure that the best projects continue to move forward. If you could advance. The project development is made of seven categories of information that determine whether a specific project is attractive to the private sector. The first four categories are the most important and are the focus of both the federal agency and private sector. The agency is the initial party that addresses these categories, focusing on the first four, but after a developer is selected, the developer will complete each category. The first category is site. The agency needs a site that can host a renewable energy power plant under a long-term land use transaction, often a lease or an easement. The characteristics of the land have to match the characteristics of the technology, and a developer and operations and maintenance provider will need to have easy access to the project. The second is resources. A detailed assessment of the renewable resource that meets industry standards is necessary. Such a study will answer important questions about resource variability and probability. The third is off-taker. The off-taker is the buyer of the energy from the renewable power plant. In some cases, the federal agency will be the sole off-taker. In much larger projects, the agency's annual load may be a fraction of the project's total annual generation, and therefore some other customer, most likely a utility, will be the primary off-taker. It is essential to find an off-taker because its purchase of electricity is a revenue stream for the project. Especially when the project is financed with debt, the off-taker agreement is usually longer than 15 years so that there can be a reasonable expectation of earning a return on investment. In addition, this category assesses any interconnection and transmission constraints. The fourth is permitting. Before a project can be constructed and interconnected to the grid, all related federal, state, and local authorizations must be granted. Often, NEPA compliance is the most important factor in this category, and it's the federal agency that leads this NEPA process. The fifth is called technology. In this category, the design and construction plans are finalized. The sixth is team. So just as banks consider the experience of the project development team when making financing decisions, the federal agency team should consist of members experienced in key areas such as contracting, real estate, legal, and security. And the final category is capital. So after the first six elements are in place, the developer can then work with the financier to reach financial close. And if you could advance. Okay. So, for example, a developer and an investor may reach a partnership flip arrangement. This slide is still in development, but it's still instructive. And if you could click once. There we go. So what we should see here is the federal agency investment in the first 3 years. And in the third year, the costs are paid by the developer who has won the solicitation. If you could click again. Thank you. So that construction, the high upfront capital cost typical of renewable energy projects is mostly funded through tax equity and debt. And then the last click. So beginning with the first year of operations, the revenues from the sale of electricity are distributed to the tax equity investor and developer in a 99-to-1 ratio and to the lender. After the tax equity investor meets his or her target internal rate of return, often after the sixth year of operations, right here, the ratio flips into a 5-to-95 ratio. If you could advance. Thanks. So zooming out, the slide summarizes the process, which is reliable and repeatable. This consistency helps reduce the risks for the project developer. Another click. So the consistency comes from the identifiable project stages so that all parties can recognize the key milestones or go, no-go decision points, and from the project development framework that provides a common understanding of the important project characteristics. The project development framework is applied iteratively and incrementally. In each iteration, you're looking for the most important fatal flaws or major risks from the seven categories I just discussed. And after an iteration, you decide whether to make another incremental investment in development. And a final click. Thank you. So consistency also comes from the common approach to a project, which begins with a federal agency pre-developing the project up to a point that a developer can take it over and complete project development and then construction and arrange for operations and maintenance. See if we could advance. So getting into the structure of the guide, there are three sections, starting with a discussion of the language differences, moving to the project developer process and the project fundamentals and development framework, and ending with a federal agency process. And the details and some of the tools are in the appendices. The next slide. The appendices provide overviews of the portfolio approach to projects, electricity markets, and the steps for applying the project development framework. They also provide tools for project development, such as checklists, an example of a pro forma, as well as examples from the Army's approach. Project development checklists in Appendix B are particularly important, and so that appendix is shown here in bold. These checklists provide not only a systematic way to assess a project, but also a way to capture lessons learned. Developers add items to their checklist as they gain additional project experience. Next slide. So I wanted to conclude with some takeaways organized by the audience of the guide. Federal agencies need private investment to get these projects built. Risk reduction is the most universal action a federal agency can take to attract developers and private capital investment. The guide provides agencies with a consistent process and frameworks so that an agency can help reduce these risks. And understanding the private process should help federal agencies understand why and how to pre-develop large-scale projects. Next slide. Project developers should be aware that there is a significant federal market for large-scale renewable energy projects. They should also be aware that with the guide, federal agencies can start to take actions that help reduce project risks and therefore protect project developers' high-risk, high-cost capital. At the same time, the private sector needs to understand how the federal agency process works. Next slide. On to utility. Utilities should know that federal agencies are committed to hosting large-scale renewable energy projects. As a result, federal agencies will need to develop strong partnerships with their local utilities. In many cases, utilities will be the primary off-taker of utility-scale renewables projects, and both will have to work together on interconnection and transmission. And now to the final slide. So thank you for your time. We're glad to have this opportunity to present. We also welcome any feedback as we are continuing to update this guide, and our contact information is provided here. And thanks again.
Okay, great. This is just a reminder, we do have time to take Q&A from our live audience. We have some electronic questions that have been submitted. If you are waiting to share a comment, you can go ahead and type that into the Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen. Again, it's just the thin box at the very bottom. Just type your text in and hit enter or press the little cartoon bubble to the right. And Boyne, if it's okay, I'm going to read off one of the comments that have come in or a question that came electronically. We have a participant that would like to know, is there a public source that shows progress towards reaching each of the goals by service or by department or agency?
This is Ann. There are a couple of sources. There is a report, but it's still in concurrence for FY12, which was our last fiscal year. If you go to the FEMP website, there is a place with a report, but the last one that's public is 2007. If you go to the, we're actually optimistic to get the new one out relatively soon. But there are, what is more public, although it's not as clear, are agency scorecards. There's a place on the White House website under probably CEQ, the Council on Environmental Quality, that talks about the federal sustainable goals and the scorecards that are related to those. And each of those links to each agency's scorecard, which talks about those goals. I wish there was a public resource for it, but we have to work within our constraints and rules of getting these reports cleared.
Great. We have another participant that wants to know if there's a centralized database showing which sites have been selected for development.
I would say no.
Are there any plans to develop it?
Excuse me?
Are there any plans for such a database to be available?
Not quite like that. Each agency has its own process. We try to provide tools to help them, resources to help them, and they are in that process. Certainly the Army's Energy Initiative Task Force is doing some of that, but they're struggling to, each agency I think is trying to figure out what is the best site for them to target, and it does take a fair amount of resources. So at this point, no, there's not a public list, although you might find some information from each agency.
Okay, great. I think in the interest of time, I think we're ready to turn things back to Adam so we can move on to our next speaker. Adam, are you ready?
Great. Yes, thanks, Jean. And we want to switch over to the discussion of the Massachusetts Military Reservation Project. And we have a group of speakers, starting off with Ms. Robes Forbes. Ms. Robes Forbes is a professional engineer with over 20 years of experience in contaminated site investigation and remediation. Ms. Forbes is a project manager with the Air Force Civil Engineer Center and has worked on the Massachusetts Military Reservation Project since 1999. Where she is responsible for construction, operation, and maintenance of remediation systems, monitoring of the groundwater plumes, program optimization, energy conservation, and renewable energy implementation. Ms. Forbes graduated with both a bachelor's and a master's degree in chemical engineering from the University of North Dakota School of Engineering and Mines. So let me turn it over to Rose Forbes. Thank you.
Can you hear us?
We can.
Great. We weren't sure if we had to do that pound six thing. Okay, yeah, so I just want to thank EPA for inviting us to participate in this webinar. And I wanted to also note that at the time we were invited, we were still the Massachusetts Military Reservation. And in just a few short weeks, it seems, we're now a Joint Base Cape Cod. So for all the participants, if you see MMR and Joint Base Cape Cod, they're one and the same. Okay, so I like to refer to us as MMR, and because it's simpler. It's actually a large area on the Upper Cape. If anyone's ever been to Cape Cod, you cross over the bridges, and the Mass Military Reservation is right there. You might not recognize it or realize it's there, but it's 22,000 acres, and it takes up about 10% of the landmass of Cape Cod. And it, there's multiple agencies here. That's part of the reason it was renamed to Joint Base. The main agencies are the Coast Guard, the 102nd Air National Guard, Camp Edwards Army National Guard, the 6th Space Warning Squadron, which is the PAVPAW's radar facility, and the VA Cemetery. And there are a number of tenants, which are listed on this next slide as the multi-use facility. And so when you're thinking about putting up a renewable energy project, you have to consider all the stakeholders and all the different agencies on the base, because there really isn't one base commander. So there's a lot of coordination to be done. And we're focusing here on renewable energy, but I just want to kind of talk about, yes, we also did energy conservation, because energy conservation is so important. It's your immediate payback. And you really should look at conserving your energy before going forward with renewable energy project. And I'm sure most people who are participating in this webinar would agree with that. But we've done energy audits and a whole host of different types of energy conservation activities as listed on this slide. We also, several of the agencies, PAVPAWS, the agency I work for, which is Air Force Civil Engineer Center, and also the Coast Guard, have participated in what's called the Demand Response Program. And it basically is a curtailment program that assists the grid in the event of high energy use, and it will help prevent the grid from failing. What it also does is it helps prevent some of the peaker plants from having to be started on those days. And typically, peaker plants use the heavier end fuels, which are, you know, have more air emissions associated with them. And just in our program alone, the Air Force Civil Engineer Center, we earned $139,000 from that program over a course of about 3 to 4 years, I believe. And we were able to turn those dollars into energy efficiency programs for our facility. But at MMR, there's a number of renewable energy projects, and you'll be hearing about each one of these. There's a few wind turbine projects. There's a two geothermal projects that the Coast Guard will be talking about, and a solar project that's the proponent is the 102nd Intelligence Wing, which is also called OTIS, Air National Guard Base. Oops, sorry. This is just a few photos of the geothermal systems that you'll hear more about from Elizabeth Kirkpatrick. This is a VA Cemetery wind turbine. It's a 50 kilowatt Elecon that was installed by the VA, And you'll hear from Mr. Steve Mellon today about his wind turbine project that's currently under construction. There's two 1.68 megawatt GE wind turbines. And then this is the photo of the landfill cap where the proposed solar array is going to be installed. And this one, in addition to all the renewable energy projects we're involved with, has been very exciting. EPA started this project by funding a feasibility study for us through the NREL. And that feasibility study found that it's a viable project, a feasibility study for it that will go to an RFP. And then this is the overall energy use for Joint Base Cape Cod or Mass Military Reservation, where you see it includes the PAVPOD wind turbines, the Air Force Civil Engineer wind turbines, and then the solar project that's I just mentioned about the RFP and the VA, and those combined will make up over 50% renewables by 2014 at our base. And then we're looking at, well, what can we do here? And there are some proposed projects that will help put renewable energy in the place of some of these air emissions. So that was just an overview. And what I really am going to be talking about now is the program that I work for, Air Force Civil Engineer Center, and our particular wind turbine projects. We're having a bit of a trouble with our screen here. So the program I work in, we're responsible for the Air Force Environmental Cleanup Program. And this slide here just shows where the contamination came from that we're cleaning up. And it has some nice historical photos. Again, MMR is a very large base, and it started operations back in the 1930s, so you can imagine all the different activities that have occurred over that time. You have fire training activities, underground storage tanks for fuels, we have Beaumont missile sites, aircraft maintenance and such. And those have resulted in source area or soil contamination that, left unabated, produced groundwater contamination, which is shown in the figure here. Those red outlines are groundwater plumes. And you can see they're not just confined to on-base. All of our plumes have gone off-base. So we have a very large program. We've built 9 pump and treat systems. At the height, we were treating about 18 million gallons per day. We're down around 12 million gallons per day now. But we have 9 pump and treat systems. We have over 100 extraction and reinjection wells, over 27 miles of pipeline, and thousands of monitoring wells. And you're probably getting an understanding of, well, if you're pumping anywhere from 12 to 18 million gallons per day, you're using a lot of energy. And where is that energy coming from? Well, before I get to that, this is just a photo of one of the pump and treat systems that we installed. It has 16 20,000-pound carbon vessels inside the treatment plant. And that's to remove the contamination that we pump up out of the groundwater. But the slide that I was getting to is a slide that we used to show the public when we were doing our presentations about proposing wind turbine projects, is that, yes, we're cleaning up the groundwater, we're taking the contamination out of the ground, we're processing and we're putting the clean water back in the ground, but the power that we're using is coming from the New England mix, which does include fossil fuel-based power, which causes air emissions. And so we proposed the wind turbines. The first wind turbine went in the southwest portion of the base, and at the time, the 102nd was in charge of the flight line, and so they had a different flying mission. And between the time that we built the first wind turbine down in this location to the time we built the second one, which was way up in the northern portion of the base, the mission changed, and the Coast Guard took over the flight line, and they had a different flying mission, and so we couldn't put other turbines down in this area. So if you're thinking to yourself, well, why did they do what they did, split their projects at 8 miles apart, that was really the reason. So it just goes to show you have a number of different agencies, and things do change at a military base, and so you just have to be flexible and be able to work with everybody. And this is our first wind turbine. It's a Furlander 1.5 megawatt. It has an 80-meter hub height, 77-meter rotor diameter. It took 5 years for us from concept to installation and operation for this wind turbine. It was just because we were new. We didn't really understand what we were doing. There were a lot of other people didn't understand what we were doing. So it took a lot of explaining and a lot of communication. And you can see it was about a $5 million project, which included studies and 2 years of O&M. And this project's jointly funded by the Air Force and Army. And so far through May, it's produced $1.4 million in credits. And our second project is shown here. There are two GE wind turbines, 1.5 megawatts. And you can see they're behind. This is the Pave Paws radar facility. They're behind the radar facility, so they're not going to conflict with the mission of Pave Paws. That ended up being a two-year project for us because we had a lot of lessons learned. We figured out what we were doing, and we were able to streamline a lot of things. And so instead of taking 5 years, we were now taking 2 years. This one cost about $9.4 million because we had to build a substation and interconnect to a transmission line. And the substation was 7.5 MVA, so that added to the cost of the overall project. And through May, you can see those two turbines have earned about $1.7 million. So the three turbines combined have offset the cost and the air emissions associated with our program here at MMR by 100%. So we are considered net zero now as far as the Air Force Environmental Cleanup Program goes. And this was the Cape Cod Times article. We were so used to getting bad press because of the contamination and taking a while to clean it up. And then now we get this front page of the Cape Cod Times that said Tower of Power. So that's the end of my presentation. And Adam, I'm not sure, do you have Steve coming up?
Exactly right. We were going to skip Captain Doyle and go to Steve at this point. I have a brief bio for him as well. Steve Mellon is a support officer for the 6th Space Warning Squadron, Cape Cod Air Force Station. And as a support officer, Mr. Mellon supervises and directs civil engineering programs on the installation, including project programming, design, and construction oversight. He oversees the emergency management program, ensuring the squadron is ready to react to natural and man-made disasters. Mr. Mellon is also responsible for security operations on the installation. He manages over 37 active duty and reserve security force members assigned to Cape Cod Air Force Station, providing around-the-clock protection of the $250 million Protection Level 1 asset. Mr. Mellon began his service with the Air Force as an active duty civil engineer officer and served for over 22 years, retiring from active duty in 2005. Following his retirement, Mr. Mellon was a civil engineering manager for ArcTech Services and then BAE Systems as part of the Solid State Phased Array Radar Systems Support Contract. Mr. Mellon began his civil service career at Cape Cod Air Force Station Support Officer in November 2007. So let me turn it over to Steve. Thanks.
Thanks, Adam, and good afternoon, everyone. Just real quickly, we'll go through a little bit of the background on our radar system and the turbines, where we put it, and kind of give you an update of where we're at with the program right now. A little bit of our background. As a PAPAWS radar facility, we're a very energy-intensive facility. When we first started looking at using the wind turbines, we're averaging about 13 million kilowatt hours of electricity annually. That worked out to about $5,000 a day. Also, when we started looking at the turbines, we had two executive orders that we were trying to meet the requirements, as a federal agency. Dealing with the consumption or using renewable energy and reducing the greenhouse gas emissions. So as part of Air Force Space Command, they were taking a look throughout our command at installations where it would make good sense to use renewable energy. And trying to follow in the footsteps of Rose and the folks at the time, AFSCE, or the Air Force Center for Engineering and the Environment, now the Air Force Civil Engineering Center. It's one of those you can't tell a player without a program as the names change. Rose and her folks had done so much work, it was really almost a no-brainer that it would make good sense for us to do similar work for Cape Cod Air Force Station and really to try and jump on most of the groundbreaking work that she had already done. The initial investigation on whether it made sense to economically to do it was completed, and it certainly made sense to do it. As part of the NEPA process for the original turbines, additional turbines were factored into it. So we were able to just go with a categorical exclusion, or a KTEX, which significantly speeded up the time for our turbines. At the end of the day, when we did all the calculations, they were looking at offsetting our energy by about 50%. Actually, the production that Rose has had on her turbines will be probably closer to 60% when we're done. You'd seen the diagrams that Rose had showed you from the Joint Base Cape Cod, or formerly the MMR. We had looked at doing the two turbines for within our property, but we only have about 100 acres. So we had to look in other locations close by, all still part of Joint Base Cape Cod, where it would make sense to put an additional turbine. So working with the Army National Guard staff, we were able to find a location very close to us. And I should say, not just the Army National Guard, but the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection. We operate within a 5,000-foot exclusion zone for flight operations due to the power of the radar. So, Gene, I don't see the green arrow, but the red circle around the area, we'll do it this way. The red circle depicts that 5,000-foot no-fly area. And as Rose had mentioned, the front part of the radar, which is about a 240-degree arc, is in front of the actual radar faces, so we can't build anything in front of that. So you're left with that wedge-shaped area behind the wind turbines, or behind the radar, that would be acceptable for wind turbines. We used to try and describe this to some folks as the Pac-Man shape, but us older folks know what that means, but the younger audiences don't seem to pick up on that anymore. So if you reduce back from that wedge shape, the area on the left of what looks like the power right-of-way, where the NSTAR's distribution lines run, is still an active training area for the Army National Guard. So we couldn't put any turbines in that area. The area that's shown now, that little pie-shaped piece, hard to tell on the photograph, but it's actually, the topography is such that you can't get turbines in there. It's actually going down a very steep hill, so there's no way to put turbines in that area. So that left us with this kind of oddball-shaped area behind the radar and out of the active training areas. We had worked through the MMR, and some other studies had shown that we could probably fit no more than 5 wind turbines in that area as total for not only for the constraints of the usage, but so the turbines wouldn't interfere with each other and steal the wind as they're operating. So after looking at all of that, we determined there was really 2 good locations for us to use. The 2 areas in red are FKEX turbines, Rose's 2 existing turbines. The 2 ones down on the bottom, one right behind the radar face, or the PayPause radar, the other one just slightly past it, is the location where we determined we could afford to build the turbines. A little closer look, Site 1, which is one that was still on Cape Cod Air Force Station property proper, and then Site 2, which is on Camp Edwards. Kind of give you a feel for what it looked like. Site 1 on Cape Cod Air Force Station, primarily scrub pine pine and scrub oak, very densely packed area. This had been previously disturbed during the construction of the radar. Site 2, or the Camp Edwards site, was actually an old battle position that used to be used many years ago as part of their training. It had been flattened, used actually as a bivouac site for them for the most part. Starting to get a little bit of regrowth, almost all just pitch pine growing up. So, again, 2 areas that seem to work very well for us. So, a little exciting excitement here this summer. We've started on the construction. This is the first site as they were finishing up the foundation. This was done about 2 weeks ago. Last week we had the pour for Site 1. So, both in similar conditions right now, we have foundations in place. and we're actually looking at getting delivery of the first parts of the tower right here before the Labor Day holiday. Then the remainder of the tower, the nacelle, and the turbine blades themselves will be right after the holiday. And we're looking at starting the actual erections of the turbines about middle to end of September. So an exciting time for us right now. So just to kind of wrap it up, when we looked at this, Space Command determined that two wind turbines would make good economic sense, not only financially to offset our current electricity bill, but also to help the command as a whole meet the goals of the executive orders. From an environmental standpoint, you know, we think we're making good use of the land as well as the current usage of the area, so no conflicts on that. And it fits in very well with the overall mission of the Joint Base Cape Cod, or formerly the MMR. So that is my presentation. If we have any questions, we'll address them a little bit later, but thank you.
Okay, well, thank you, Steve. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Elizabeth Kirkpatrick. Elizabeth Kirkpatrick is a registered environmental manager, a graduate of Montana State University with a background in geology and environmental science. Ms. Kirkpatrick has worked on the Massachusetts Military Reservation on Cape Cod since 2001. Today, she's employed by the U.S. Coast Guard as the acting director of the Environmental Health and Safety Department. Ms. Kirkpatrick is also part of the organization's Energy Conservation Initiative. So let me turn it over to Elizabeth Kirkpatrick. Thank you.
From the U.S. Coast Guard at Air Station Cape Cod, located on Joint Base Cape Cod, where we have 3,500 acres of land on the property and a number of facilities here. And I'm just going to touch base a little bit over our geothermal and energy efficiency measures that we've done the past few years. To begin, I'd like to note that there are a variety of terms used for the same type of system, such as geothermal heat pumps, ground source heat pumps, geo-exchange systems, and so on. But whichever term is used, the terminology is pretty much the same. And throughout this presentation, when I use the term geothermal, I'll be referring to the stored solar energy in the Earth's crust, which in the continental U.S. averages a near-constant temperature of about 50 degrees Fahrenheit, approximately 10 feet below the surface year-round.
Elizabeth, before you go any further, we've got a number of people who are having hard times hearing you. I don't know if you're using a headset, if you can pick up a handset phone or try to speak a little bit louder into your handset. That'd be great.
I am on my handset. I'll try to speak a little bit louder if that is better.
Yeah, that sounds better. Thank you.
Okay, great. So the U.S. Coast Guard has two large aircraft hangars here and a third large facility in the pre-construction design phase that utilize geothermal energy by means of heat pumps to moderate the indoor air temperature. The primary components of these systems are the ground loop and the heat pump, where the ground loop is a closed-loop system of underground piping filled with water and often refrigerant, where the heat pump transfers the heat from the solution brought to the surface to the indoor environment. In the summer, the geothermal system acts like your home refrigerator, removing heat from the air and depositing it in the ground. And in the winter, it withdraws heat from the earth and transfers it to the indoor environment. The heat pump moderates the temperature to about 50 degrees Fahrenheit, and then the conventional heating and cooling system further conditions the air to a comfortable temperature. Conventional ductwork is used to circulate the air to the various rooms. And we personally use natural gas as a backup. So this is just an alternative to fully relying on natural gas. The Department of Energy and EPA both endorse geothermal or ground source heat pumps as one of the most energy efficient and environmentally friendly systems for heating, cooling, and hot water heating systems available. Because the heat is transferred, not created, they reduce consumption up to 50%, and investments are often recouped in a few years. By reducing the burning of fossil fuels and using factory-sealed refrigeration systems, which will seldom or never have to be recharged, the geothermal systems conserve natural resources and contribute to the protection of the ozone layer. In the continental U.S., it may be a viable option for new construction and Existing structures may be retrofitted to install geothermal systems. And if space is restricted, the ground loop may be installed vertically rather than horizontally to accommodate the size of the property. In 2012, the Air Station Cape Cod constructed a new aircraft hangar to accommodate four Marine Patrol aircraft. The hangar, which is about 85,000 square feet in size, was built to LEED Silver standards, utilizing a variety of sustainable and energy efficiency measures. One such measure was installation of the geothermal heat pump system to moderate the HVAC. This was our second endeavor with geothermal, as we had retrofitted a much older aircraft hangar with great success almost a decade prior. Before I delve into the details of the geothermal system, I would like to highlight a few of the other features in the building. The building was many of the materials were produced locally using recycled materials, and the wood was certified by the Forestry Stewardship Council, and much of the construction waste was recycled. We installed a rainwater collection system, which supplies water to the toilets, and all other stormwater runoff is re-infilled on-site, recharging our sole source aquifer. Low-flow fixtures were utilized, as well as drought-resistant plants to eliminate the need for irrigation. Occupancy sensors and individual thermostats, large ceiling fans, and the geothermal system provide an energy saving of 35%. The geothermal component of the HVAC system was selected based on a 25-year life cycle cost comparison. And you can find the program that we use, Building Life Cycle Costs, on the FEMP website. So this is the screenshot of the main page of our SCADA system. And you can see in the center, there is the outdoor air temperature. There is the temperature of the cold water loop, which is from the well fields. The hot water supply loop, which is a supplemental loop that has been added to the system. And then on each side, links to the different views of the system. The well field is a closed ground loop system, and it contains 70% water and 30% propylene glycol. The well field is about a half an acre, and it is in this rendering over right in this area. It consists of 64 vertical wells in an 8x8 arrangement. The well depth is 250 feet, and each borehole is less than 5 inches. The piping is 3/4 inch, and we use a thermally enhanced grout for a more efficient heat exchange. There are two condensing water pumps that maintain a continuous flow in the well field of about 300 gallons per minute. And the system, as I said, is supplemented by natural gas. Here's an overview of the plant. On the top right, this is the connection to the well field. And then top left, this is the connection to 36 ground source heat pumps and 6 air source heat pumps that condition the air to the desired temperature and achieve adequate indoor air quality. The lower loop is the hot water loop that supplements the cold water loop, and with 2 high-efficient boilers. In the event that the cold water loop drop below 50 degrees that it needs to stay at for proper function, this lower system will kick on and bring the cold water loop up to 50. It is also used to provide hot water for the ice melting system and the hangar door rails. Most of the time, unless it's very cold out, this supplemental hot water loop is not in operation. Given the success we've had with the two other geothermal systems, we have plans to build a third. We will soon be constructing a new facility. It's a barracks building that will have 50 units for single adults to live. And we plan to install the well field for this facility underneath the parking lot. In addition to our geothermal, we are in the pre-concept phase of a solar project as well. And EPA is in the process of completing a feasibility study for our proposed site, which we greatly appreciate and look forward to reviewing. So the Coast Guard is looking right down here. All of this orange property is Coast Guard. So we are looking right here at this site, and you can see up here is where the Army Air National Guard is looking to develop their solar project, And then we have two private developers looking to develop solar in the neighborhood. Unlike the Air National Guard's plan, the Coast Guard intends to connect to the grid outside of the meter in order to virtually net meter, where we will use the resource not only to offset our electrical consumption here at Air Station Cape Cod, but also for the small boat stations, the numerous small boat stations along the southeastern Massachusetts. We've implemented a number of energy conservation measures through our 43 facilities and 350 residential units. Most you are probably familiar with, and upgrading lighting and occupancy sensors and on and on and on. We've done energy assessments and installed advanced metering, and we consolidate next size property whenever we have an appropriate opportunity. And as you can see from our, kind of see from our charts, it's been a considerable cost savings and energy reduction. And that concludes my portion, and thank you very much for the time.
Great. Well, thank you so much. And I'm not sure whether Captain Doyle is...
Thanks again. This applies only to Captain Doyle. Please feel free to speak up. I don't see him in the webinar.
Okay.
We do have some questions from the audience, if you'd like to take some of those now.
This is Rose Forbes. I can run through his slides real quick if we have time.
Well, we do have time, and that's what I was going to suggest perhaps, is that we finish out the various presentations on the MMR, and then we can do questions on that. Does that work, Jean?
Absolutely. I'm pulling up Captain Doyle's slides right now. And Rose, okay. I'll go ahead and give you rights so that you can walk through that deck in about one moment.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, Rose, whenever you're ready.
Okay, we must have a little bit of it. There we go. Great. Thank you so much. All right, so Steve Mellon has showed me how to use the green arrow, so I should be all set with that. Thank you, Steve. Okay, so this is a presentation on one of the solar projects on the base landfill, and also a very interesting concept that we're proceeding with on energy storage, and we're very excited about this. So I'll touch on that during this presentation. We already did talk about MMR, Joint Base Cape Cod, and this focuses on the base grid. It gets very complicated with respect to the electrical distribution here at the base. We do have a base grid that services a number of the agencies, but in addition to that, we have independent NSTAR feeders that come onto the base and tie in some of the other agencies' electrical load. But this is just talking about the base grid. And here is a figure, I almost did it again, showing where the proposed solar array is. This is the base landfill. We closed and capped it in 1995, and we manage it under our program. That's why you know something about this project. We have a primary feeder that comes in from the electrical utility called NSTAR. That comes in and services the base substation. And then you can see all these different colored lines. Those are all various feeders that go out from the substation, and the solar array will be connected to one of these feeders, and it lends itself to either a net metered application or a behind the meter application. And so there's going to be an RFP that goes out basically asking for bidders to bid on both of those options. This one, this slide shows an exploded pie chart of the energy use on the base grid and all the different agencies. I know it's tiny and some of the words might be hard to read, but you can just see the distribution of who uses what on the base grid. And more importantly, what's the peak load? Of course, you need to know that to be able to design your solar project. The peak load for MMR is about 4.5 megawatts, but it's expected to increase in the future due to some changing missions. The average load is anywhere from about 3.5 megawatts. The annual usage, this actually should be 25,900 megawatt hours, so close to 26,000 megawatt hours. Again, the peak load. And here in the Northeast, as I'm sure a lot of the participants realize, we have a high energy cost. In this case, it used to be about 18 cents a kilowatt hour. It's gone down a little bit to 16 cents a kilowatt hour, but that still is a significant cost to the military. There's the local local distribution by NSTAR. I mentioned the 102nd owns the power grid and the substation. They have 7 main feeders, and there are also standby diesel generators that are used for backup power. And I'm not sure why he has the slide in, other than maybe these are all the different agencies that are involved with the solar array project, which I'm guessing that's what it is, given that the EPA funded the feasibility study, NREL did the feasibility study. Defense Logistics Agency is the contracting service center that's going to be issuing that RFP. The 102nd Intelligence Wing is the proponent. Captain Doyle did the environmental assessment himself in-house and saved the taxpayer quite a bit of money. And the Air Force Civil Engineer Center is who I work for. We manage the landfill cap. So we're all working this project together. This is a picture of the landfill cap and aerial. It's 37 acres available. That's the capped portion. And then the south and southwest facing slopes of the cap lend themselves to about 6 megawatts capacity. The idea is going to be a developer-based power purchase agreement for the contract type, and it's going to result in close to $9.2 million in savings for electricity used on the base grid. And he's anticipating it's going to be online in the second quarter of 2014. Now, talking about the energy storage project, what's really exciting about this is that we are going to be a test case for a project that's being put forth by AMBRI. AMBRI is a spinoff from MIT. One of their graduates started this company. AMBRI is actually short. It's the middle part of Cambridge, Massachusetts. They recently received a grant from MassCEC, Mass Clean Energy Center, for $150,000 to explore this innovative energy storage project. And what they're going to do with that is they're going to do the feasibility study, economic analysis associated concerning the base grid, and ending up with a prototype of a few kilowatts. The idea being we would scale it up, assuming that all works out, we would scale it up to multi-megawatt energy storage and combine it with our renewable energy projects here at MMR. The other people involved with that are, of course, Joint Base Cape Cod, but Mass Development, Raytheon, and the analysis group that's doing the financial analysis. And this is a depiction of the different types of cell, energy storage cells. It's liquid metal that they use, and very cost-effective and very long-lived, with very little operational issues. So we're looking at it not just for a net zero or being able just to store the energy, because as everybody knows, solar is an intermittent energy source as well as wind, because the sun doesn't always shine, the wind doesn't always blow. But energy storage, at least with an application like this, is going to change the way we look at renewable energy. It's going to get us towards an energy secure base. It can act as a single facility UPS or a UPS for an entire grid. And MMR is considered a shelter for folks on the Cape, or a safe haven, as Captain Doyle mentions it here. And also, we support large-scale recovery support, like in a big weather event that we had here. We had NSTAR actually mobilize to the base and help with getting everybody's power back on the Cape and in nearby areas. And here's a photo of that. 1,200 people, 600 trucks. One weekend, they used over 12 acres, and they utilized our facilities here. The good thing was our grid, well, so we did have some problems with power in our grid, but not as much as the rest of the grid on the Cape. And so what happened, what we're looking forward to with energy storage is being able to go on renewable energy and have a definite power supply available to us in the future, in the case that the grid is compromised. The other thing, energy independence, it eliminates our reliance on the commercial power, which is very important for military base. We can also incorporate elements of the peak load shedding and the demand response program. We can become our own microgrid in times of curtailment. We'll reduce our consumption on fossil fuels and our carbon footprint as well. And we won't have to use as many backup generators. And then the renewables can act as the primary power sources at that point. And that was really the goal behind the energy storage, this feasibility study project that we're embarking on. And that's it for that presentation. So that's it for MMR.
Okay, great. Adam, if it's okay with you, we'll go ahead and take a break for questions.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Okay. So the first question comes in from one of our participants, and they are asking, how could local governments with closed landfills who are considering solar arrays on the landfill work with the FEMP to help achieve RE goals? I think this question might be directed back at Boyan and Ann. So again, I'll read that question out loud. How could local governments with closed landfills considering solar arrays on the landfill work with the FEMP to help achieve RE goals?
Well, this is Boyan. I guess they can use our guide, and perhaps we could entertain a conversation, but I think there's some specifics here to the repowering program that I think EPA would be better to assist with. And that's what I would say at this point.
And this is Adam. I was going to volunteer that we have done a little bit of work and developed a handbook on thinking about the key considerations for putting a solar array on a closed landfill. So I would certainly refer folks to that site and that document, and certainly we are open to engage if people want to call us and talk more about the specifics of the project, and depending on where, we could get our regional folks involved as well.
I agree. Our next participant would like to know, what has the experience of the presenters been for time for return on the investment, and that's dollar-wise? Does that also account for operation and maintenance of these systems and future replacement costs? So I think this is a general question posed to everyone. You've been investing money in setting up these systems, so when did you really experience a return on your investment?
Well, this is Rose Forbes. I can start off with an answer. Because we've only been operating for a few years, obviously we haven't achieved our return on investment yet for the wind turbines anyway. As part of the basis of design, feasibility study, economic analysis, that was all kind of estimated or predicted looking at about a 10-year return on investment. Because we own and operate the wind turbines and we used our cleanup funds, we weren't able to take advantage of certain incentives from the state or the federal government. So we're looking at about a 10-year return on investment, and yes, that does include operations and maintenance and even a gearbox exchange in that first 10 years for the turbines.
And this is Boyan speaking. So for the large-scale projects, agencies really don't have the capital to invest in those. That's why they're looking for the private sector. And in those arrangements, if the agency is going to be the off-taker, then the deal only really happens if the developer can offer a price that's below the utility price. So in that sense, the return on investment is seen right away. But for other projects, like we just mentioned, when they're spent with direct appropriations, then those are, can be 10 plus years. And I guess I'd also refer you back to that slide I had on the developers, on the private sector's cash flow model. And so you can see when it comes to some of these, the partnership flip is often for the wind projects, that after the sixth year, at least the tax equity investor gets their return back. But the bank requires several more years to do that. So there's a reason why PPAs, for example, are 20 years.
Does any of the other speakers want to chime in?
Hi, this is John Herrera with Pantex, future speaker, but that our experience is consistent with what Ian just elaborated on. With the third-party financing contracts, you're going to have a longer break-even point, and pretty much conceptually that break-even point is going to be when the contract terminates. So in our scenario, it's going to be 18 years before we achieve that break-even point, but our system is anticipated to last 25 years, so we'll get a significant return during those remaining 7 years. Now, if the government was able to provide the upfront capital to purchase that our system outright, then the break-even point is significantly reduced, potentially what we estimated to about 12 years to reach that break-even.
Great, thank you. Adam, we have a clarifying question from the audience. You had referenced a handbook when you were commenting on an earlier question, talking about, I think it was solar power on a landfill. Do you have a URL where that handbook can be found?
Absolutely. There's a URL on the webinar that goes to our homepage. And then within that homepage is a section called Redevelopment Tools and Resources. And then under that, you'll see listed, and this is all on the homepage, a document called Best Practices for Siting Solar Photovoltaics on Municipal Solid Waste Landfills. And so that's a PDF document that you can directly download from the homepage of the website.
Okay, great. All right, we're going to take one more question online. And this question asks, how deep are the geothermal wells for the USCG? I believe that's U.S. Coast Guard.
Hi, this is Elizabeth Kirkpatrick. Our geothermal wells are about 250 feet deep. Any other follow-on questions?
Not that have come in yet.
Okay. And there's 64 of them in an 8x8 arrangement.
Okay, great. Well, I think that'll close out the Q&A section for this portion of the webinar. And Adam, if it's okay, can we move on to our next speaker?
That'd be great. And so we're switching from Cape Cod to the Pantex site, and it's my pleasure to introduce Mr. John Herrera. John Herrera serves as a Level 1 Federal Project Director for the National Nuclear Security Administration in their production office in Amarillo, Texas. He's been a Project Management Institute project management professional since 2010 and is a Level 2 Contracting Officer representative. He graduated with multiple degrees from New Mexico State University and is originally from Abilene, Texas. So let me turn to John. Thank you.
Thank you. And before I get started, I just want to give kudos to Rose and her gang up there in Cape Cod. I was fortunate enough to hear Rose speak last fall, and you can hear some excitement in her voice with their accomplishments. And hopefully out of this webinar, all the audience can piggyback on that excitement and actually see that some of these projects actually can get accomplished. So if nothing else, hopefully we can communicate that message to you. So part of that message is this opening slide. You know, this is something very tangible that we're very excited about here at Pantex. You know, the vision about 2008, the vision was conceived, and here we are already next week planning a groundbreaking ceremony, and have a whole list of stakeholder participating in that, including the EPA. Ron Curry, our regional administrator for Region 6, is going to be in attendance, along with Camille Huaney from our local EPA administrator. So we're very excited about their participation, and we're very excited about finally getting some shovels in the ground and erecting these wind turbines. This system will, as far as we can tell, be the largest federally owned wind farm in the government. And as far as we understand, this is the first awarded ESP contract in support of the President's performance contracting challenge. So we're very excited at this point in time. There's a lot of firsts for this one for the government, and hopefully we can instill some confidence in the rest of our federal agencies to follow along behind us. I'm John Herrera. I function as the Pantex Renewable Energy Project project manager and also the contracting officer representative for the ESPC contract. Just to give you, I'm forgetting my slides here on screen. Okay, so some of the things I want to talk about are briefly talk about the Pantex plant mission and our background, some of the federal energy goals that are driving this initiative, the original PREP vision and how it's actually being realized, which isn't exactly as we envisioned it, but it's, you know, it's kind of the squiggly line to your end destination. I want to go over some of the specific contract and system attributes. And then I think it's important to touch on some of the project management structure that you might use in any of your future projects. And then there's a unique R&D aspect to our initiative. And then there is a future PREP phase two that we are in the conceptual works on as we speak. Before I dive too deep into the wind system, I want to just touch on the mission of the Pantex plant. But before I even get there, I want to just touch on the mission of NNSA. NNSA is a semi-autonomous organization under the Department of Energy. We're responsible for the management and security of the nation's nuclear weapons, nuclear nonproliferation, and naval reactors program. So DOE is our parent organization. But we are semi-autonomous so that we can maintain focus on that important mission for the government. Now, the Pantex plant itself has a unique mission in fulfilling NNSA's mission. Our mission is securing America as the NNSA's production integrator and provider of the nuclear deterrent to the Department of Defense. So consider us your local tire and lube shop for our nuclear stockpile. The weapons come in one door, we fix them up, grease everything that needs to be lubricated, and send them out the other end back into deployment. We're located approximately 17 miles northeast of Amarillo, Texas. It is a government-owned and contractor-operated facility. We reside on approximately 18,000 acres and employ approximately 3,400 people. Provided here is an aerial view of the Pantex plant. You can easily see the operational center of the plant, pretty much where the facilities are located. In the black box on the right side of the screen is the 1,500 acres of greenfield property that is federally owned and will be the location of our ESPC acquired wind farm. If you notice, also important to point out is the dark green circular features, geographical features. Those are playas, and those are natural collection ponds for water. Now, we have a distinct linkage to the EPA that I'll touch on briefly. The plant was established in 1942 to build conventional munitions and high explosive compounds in support of World War II. And then in 1951, the plant was reclaimed by the Atomic Energy Commission as a nuclear weapons production facility. And then, like I alluded to, our current operations include development, testing, and fabrication of high explosive components and nuclear weapons assembly and disassembly, and interim storage of plutonium and weapon components and component surveillance. The Pantex plant's historical waste management practices haven't been the best, and because of that, there has been a large release of chemical and radionuclide constituents into the environment. Therefore, the plant was placed on the EPA National Priority List in 1991, and since then has embarked on aggressive remediation efforts. We currently operate multiple zones of in-situ bioremediation wells, injection wells, and also operate two pump and treat plants clean contaminants from a perched aquifer that sits below the plant. Now, it looks like I just lost my connection. I can attempt to reconnect.
I'm still here. Okay. You can reconnect, and if you have a hard copy, just keep talking, and we'll go through it for you.
I'll go off my hard copy and just ask you to switch for me, if that's okay.
Certainly. Absolutely.
So if I can go to the next slide. This slide, you'll see a ground-level view of the 1,500 acres that were identified in the previous slide. As you can see, the landscape is relatively flat with no geographical barriers to any wind that blows. That's one of the primary reasons why the wind resource here is so rich. Back in the distance, if you notice, there are multiple private wind developments already operating. I can look out my window and see all of them. And so we're relatively late to the party here at Pantex, but we're glad to be joining. You can see the call next week. Next slide, please. So some of the renewable energy goals and requirements that we're trying to achieve, of course, the 7.5% renewable energy usage, which has recently been increased to 20% by 2020. And then half of annual renewable energy coming from sources and agencies on federal property, and the initiative to increase renewable energy use and implement projects on agency property. Next slide, please. So the original PREP vision back in 2008 was to install wind energy or a wind energy system up to 80 megawatts of nameplate capacity with Texas Tech University as a public-private partnership. Texas Tech resides a little over 100 miles south, directly south of Amarillo, and because of the strong energy industry commitment to developing this region of the country, Texas Tech was wanted to position themselves as a R&D leader for that industry. But they needed one thing. They needed public lands where they could build an R&D center of excellence. And we partnered up with them to try to achieve that vision. We received critical decision zero back in 2009 to move forward with the concept, but hit a barrier in 2010 with our critical decision one. And basically, we weren't able to move past our CD1 phase due to a lack of program sponsorship. So here we are again at lack of capital funding for embarking on such a large undertaking. To give you some context, phase one, in terms of their original vision of 80 megawatts, phase one will only be 11.5 megawatts. So the original vision is still a large undertaking. Next slide, please. So the lack of capital funding deferred us to third-party financing, which is where we arrived at the ESPC contract strategy. So we put together an RFP to design and install and operate a 9 to 15 megawatt wind farm using the FAA-approved locations, which at the time were just those five. We approached it as a firm fixed price contract with an ESPC, and that's an important distinction I want to make. We elect, because NNSA has its own contracting authority, we elected to not utilize the Department of Energy provided two-step model for their ESPC contracts. And the primary reason for that was because we already knew what technology we wanted to utilize,
and therefore we could skip step one and go straight to step two. And so because of that, we felt that we were in a good position to go ahead and put that contract out as a more of a normal firm fixed price type arrangement. One of the salient features of that structure also was the federal ownership of that system once it was to be put into operations. Siemens Government Technologies was selected in May of this year. The contract value is $50.5 million and will cover 18 years. In developing that contract and making the selection, you know, I want to touch on our selection process. We felt it was important because this renewable technology was not a core competency to the Pantex plant and more than likely isn't a core competency to most of our colleagues out on this call today. So we believed it to be in our best interest to make the acquisition under the arrangements of a best value acquisition and therefore choose a bidder who could provide evidence of their strong corporate experience and past performance over the system capability and cost of the system. So again, we felt like partnering with somebody that had been proven, has been proven in doing the system was our most important selection feature. Next slide, please. I'll touch on some of the wind system features and specifically, again, Siemens Government Technologies will be constructing and operating the system. It is an 11.5 megawatt system composed of five 2.3 megawatt Siemens turbines with 101 meter blades. The ESPC contractor will provide a 5-year full system warranty and 5 years of maintenance with five option years for years 6 through 10. Our strategy on the option maintenance option years was that we believe that the local industry in this territory was going to mature significantly over the next 5 years, where we would have multiple options of choosing a third-party maintenance provider and provide a better value to the government if that was to realize itself. So we left ourselves the option to go to a third-party maintenance provider if chosen. The system will produce 47,000 megawatt hours a year of electricity. To give you context of what we use here, we use approximately 72,000 megawatt hours of electricity here at Pantex plant. So that those five turbines will provide over 60% of our annual production, our annual electric needs here at Pantex. This is the interconnection is behind the meter. That is a distinct element to understand. So the system will provide power directly to the plant behind the meter, so it will not connect to the regulated utility grid provided by our electric provider. The system life, as I mentioned earlier, is expected to be 25 years. Next slide, please. So more details about the energy savings aspect. The expected savings in year one is a little over $1.7 million. And for 25 years of the system life, that would equate to almost $85 million of energy savings, and that's assuming a 5% energy escalation annually. So the simple cost-benefit analysis, as you can see below there, would put us almost $34 million in the positive over that 25-year system life. Next slide, please. Another significant advantage of our project is the surplus renewable energy credits. Because the electricity will be produced on federal property, we will be eligible for the double counting bonus, and therefore the 47,000 RECs produced by the system will be accounted for DOE agency reporting purposes as 94,000 RECs per year.
So to meet this 7.5% requirement, we are currently purchasing 5,400 RECs a year. And with the new requirement, we would be purchasing almost 15,000 RECs per year. But with our own renewable generation, we will no longer have to be purchasing RECs, and we'll have a significant amount of surplus RECs upon which we can begin to spread across the rest of our NNSA and DOE facilities. Next slide, please. Some of the historical milestones to get us to where we're at today. Again, I touched briefly on some of these. We received CD0 in 2009. We requested and actually received a qualifying facility designation in 2009 also. And that feature allows us to push surplus electricity that's generated from the system, which is estimated to be about 8% of the annual power production. We have the ability now to push that power at an avoided cost rate back to the local utility. But we had to have that qualifying facility designation to be able to do that. We, again, did not receive CD1 in April 2010. Therefore, we opted for the ESPC acquisition strategy in 2011. One of the long lead items was the FAA-approved turbine locations, and those were not received until 2012. Once those were received, we released the request for proposal shortly thereafter, made the contract award in May of this year, and plan to be operational in July of next year. Next slide, please. I'll transition to some of the more tactical elements of our project, the project management aspects of it. Next slide, please. Here is a work breakdown structure down to four levels. But the three primary levels that we had to do work on were the development activities, of course, the acquisition activities, and then we're now in the implementation phase. The development activities, the primary ones, are going to be the NEPA analysis, the investment grade data, and the FAA approved locations. And you'll start to see a nice resonance between what I'm going to cover here and what is in Ann and Boyan's presentation earlier about developing renewable projects over 10 megawatts. So the development processes, again, it's all about reducing risk to the potential partners or private partners. And these three primary areas are long lead, high risk items for those partners. So I would highly suggest devoting enough resources to be able to communicate with certainty the status of each one of those to your private partners, and therefore they'll feel much more comfortable in pursuing a partnership with you. Now, the acquisition strategy, the acquisition approach is going to be dependent on how you want to, what you want to accomplish, and therefore you're going to have to put together a team of acquisition and technical experts that can link those technical pieces along with the contracting strategy together. That's quite an art form in itself, and I would recommend providing yourself enough time to get past a learning curve there, communicate formally through your acquisition processes. And then once that goes well, you'll jump into the implementation stage, where you're actually doing any design and construction, and then operational work with your system. The two primary areas there to highlight are the interconnection activities, and those are going to be the activities that you're going to need to pursue to allow the system to interconnect with onto your grid, either behind the meter or even in front of the meter. And those are typically long lead items also. So you'll need to engage your local utility to identify the scheduling of those activities, incorporate those into your project schedule. The utility tariffs, if those are applicable, are also a very sensitive element. And more than likely, if you have to deal with tariffs, there is going to be they're thick legal documents, so you're more than likely going to need to acquire some sort of expert consultant to be able to help you sift and make sense of those documents until you get yourself up to speed on what they're actually saying. So again, allow yourself enough time to be able to navigate through those. And then the construction, more than likely most of our audience out here does have some experience in capital construction. Depending on the technology, the construction could be simple or complex, because our system here is going to be construction on a greenfield location separate from our operation side of the plant, using our wind technology, which is very mature. In the private industry, we feel that to be a very low-risk activity for the project. Next slide, please. So some of the key resources that you're going to need to put together to achieve your vision is the most important element you're going to need to obtain is a strong champion for your project. More than likely, pursuing an endeavor such as this is going to be outside of your organization's mission and core competency. So a lot of people are probably going to look at these types of proposals kind of funny, and therefore you're going to need that strong champion to help push that vision through where other people can't quite see it yet. And also, if you're in the federal government, part of the execution entails navigating through a lot of the bureaucratic barriers that are placed before us, and again, that's where the champion comes in to help push the project through those that bureaucracy when it arises, and it will arise frequently. Design engineering, we acquired the services of one of the DOE national laboratories, or multiple laboratories, to help us do our design engineering. One of the long lead items that you will encounter if you pursue a wind development is to put in for your FAA applications, you're going to have to know the exact location of where you're going to construct that turbine. To know the exact location of where the turbines are going to place, you're going to need some sort of expert to do some sort of preliminary design of what that turbine array is going to look like. And there is an element of optimization in that design, so hopefully that expert will be able to design an array in an optimal format, and therefore you can be able to have confidence that system will be productive once you go out to private industry. System engineering is an also critical piece, because we're a government-owned, contracted-operated facility. Our M&O contractor has a core mission that they have to achieve, and very important mission for the federal for our government, and therefore there is no room for instability and non-reliability of that power as it comes to our plant. So we need a strong integration by our M&O contractor to make sure that the two systems marry up each other and don't compromise the mission of the Pantex plant. The contracting office, again, I alluded to the learning curve that is going to be that should be expected as you pull together these technical experts and your contracting office to try to achieve your acquisition purpose. And then the utility management piece, as you do your interconnection and then any tariff negotiations or interfacing, you're going to need some pretty expert people, which might, in our scenario, we had to acquire the services of our agency attorney and expert consultants to help us navigate through some of those landmines. But the good thing is all of these resources are available to you at your disposal. And I think one of the previous question is, you know, how do we get ourselves started? I think you're taking the first step in attending this webinar, because these webinars do facilitate you connecting to each one of these elements that are needed to achieve your project. Next
John,
slide, please.
Just yes. Real quick, a time check. We've got about a minute or so left. Thanks.
How long, I'm sorry?
The session ends roughly around 4 p.m., so about 9 minutes left in our scheduled time.
Okay, I should be able to breeze through the rest of it. Okay, I'm on slide 17, titled Development. I touched through most of those elements briefly. The one I'll highlight is the 12 months of investment-grade data that's going to be needed. You're going to need to construct some sort of high-resolution data gathering mechanism. And again, the EPA and DOE can assist you in accomplishing that. Next slide, please. The acquisition, I covered all of those salient elements. I can move past there. Next slide, please. Implementation, again, I covered the distinct features there already. Next slide, I covered the important elements of that. Next slide, I'm on tariff interconnection. I've covered the important elements of that. Next slide, R&D collaboration. We have a memorandum of understanding with Texas Tech University, who was involved in the original vision to accomplish the R&D activities. And even though this is an ESPC contract, they're going to be really constrained on just what we say touching the turbine, anything that affects the performance. But because this is a federally owned system, there's going to be a massive amount of raw data that we, NNSA, can now provide to Texas Tech to analyze. So they're very happy that they can now get their hands on some of that raw data, which, come to behold, is actually pretty hard to get your hands on from the private industry. Next slide, slide 23. Phase two, again, the original vision was 80 megawatts. This first phase is 11.5. So phase two is in the works. We're starting to fill in the blanks of what that acquisition would look like, and we're using the nice parameters that's been provided by Ann and Boyan to help achieve that, and hopefully in the next 5 years we'll get some traction on phase two. So last slide, if there's any questions, but before any questions, I would just emphasize again some of the key things. Get yourself a project champion. Connect with the government knowledge base because it is out there. Know that the private industry is targeting the federal government. There's a lot of the low-hanging fruit renewable energy projects are starting to get harder to come by, so they're looking for a different target market, and they're targeting the federal government. And eliminate risk. So focus on the NEPA analysis, focus on getting the appropriate land rights and the FAA approvals. And if you accomplish all that, then you should feel confident in accomplishing your project. I'll take questions if there are any.
Okay, great. We do have time for questions. If you haven't submitted them yet, you can use the Q&A window in the lower right corner. We will continue to let people enter in questions, both for both John Herrera as well as our earlier speakers. We will take a few moments to do any wrap-up questions as well. So while we wait for some additional questions, John, one of the things that has been coming in from some of our online participants are just references to a lot of acronyms that were contained in your presentation. And I think they've gone ahead and actually looked up what some of the acronyms are. But I'm just going to read some of them, and hopefully you can confirm the correct definition. So the first acronym was ESCP, which they're asking if it refers to Energy Saving Performance Contract.
That's correct.
Okay. Next acronym was actually the double acronym, which was the NPO, which is the NNSA, or National Nuclear Security Admin Production Office.
That's correct.
Okay. And then the next acronym was NREL, or NURL, the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Excellent. So we do have all the correct definitions spelled out for those acronyms. Our next question comes in from an online participant. It's actually getting into the project that you were talking about, and they want to know, how can power be pushed back if the system is only connected to the plant behind the meter versus net metering?
Yeah, so the power is able to flow both ways. Unfortunately, our carried through the qualifying facility status, which was authorized through FERC. It becoming a qualifying facility, which you can actually self-certify yourself, forces a local utility to purchase any power that is produced by an independent generator at their avoided cost rates. And those avoided cost rates are dependent on each utility's equation of what that value is.
Okay,
so
great.
It is a legal mechanism that allows generation to be sold back to local utilities.
Okay. We do have a question, and I think, John, we're going to push it to you, but this might be open to some of the other presenters. One participant has commented on partnerships with higher education institutions, and you definitely highlighted one at Texas, and they've seen other universities mentioned in other projects. So they just want to know, how common is a partnership with an academic institution? Is that something that someone should pursue if they're going down this course, or advantages or disadvantages to going that route? And John, I guess we'll let you comment first on the partnership with Texas.
Okay, it was a win-win for both of us. Texas Tech was bringing the expertise and the development to the table where we were lacking, but we were providing the available property that we had, and there was also a nice incentive for us. The original vision included the construction of an administrative complex where there would be classroom facilities, et cetera, and Pantex was going to receive some benefit from that administrative complex. It was a structure that just happened to happen. They had a need, and we had what they needed, and they were able to provide a consideration to us that was attractive.
Okay, great, thank you. Would any of the other presenters care to comment if they have pursued partnerships with academic institutions, or perhaps they're considering it in the future? Okay, well, I'll take silence as a no. I don't see any other additional questions in the queue. So it looks like we've come, here we go. We do have another question that snuck in here. And again, this is getting back to the academic relationship. Our participant would like to know, how is the university facility paid for?
Well, I don't, this is Boyne, so we don't really work with universities. I'm just aware, though, that there are some universities that are good partners and for developers, at least. What comes to mind is, I think, Oklahoma State University and maybe Ohio State, where they have these innovative green power purchase programs where they buy all their energy from a wind farm. So they help a wind farm be constructed. These are sometimes, 100-megawatt-plus projects.
Okay.
Universities can be good off-takers.
Okay, great. Thank you.
This is Adam. I was looking for specifics, which I'm having trouble finding, but we had attended the Brownfields Conference, and there was a gentleman in the Atlanta area that talked about working with local colleges and universities, not necessarily on the project development side of it, but perhaps even before then in terms of getting students and professors and whatnot to help in the feasibility study and site selection side of it. So I think there was some creative thinking there of using local resources to supplement the investigation as well as the development phase. So I just want to mention that idea.
Okay.
Yeah, what we've seen with Texas Tech in the recent years with the maturity of the local wind industry is they're adding curriculum and therefore attracting students from Texas that are going for degrees in renewable wind-specific technologies. So, you know, as, you know, the universities are reacting to the private industry's needs appropriately, and therefore they're trying to leverage those with these R&D partnerships in their territories. So depending on what resource is most lucrative in your area, that you might see the university starting to move in that direction.
Okay, great. Well, we're just after 4 o'clock p.m. Eastern. I don't see any additional questions in the queue. Adam, if it's okay with you, would you like to share any closing thoughts with our audience before we start our closeout procedures?
Really just a big thank you to everyone involved. I think bringing both the guide together with these real examples, I like how John put it about projects can get accomplished. And we have some great examples here that people have gone through, as well as this broader guide looking at the development process from different stakeholder perspectives, looking at it at different stages and the different components associated with it. So, again, we're thinking about what kind of tools, what kind of cross-fertilization and sharing of expertise and information can help propel these projects, renewable projects generally, and renewable projects on contaminated lands. So I will thank everybody again and there.
Okay, great. Thank you. And I'm going to go ahead and also extend a great deal of gratitude to the over 100 live participants who joined us from all over the country today. I also want to extend thanks to the numerous presenters who joined us from their various locations. Today's session was recorded. All of the materials that were presented are available to actually download from the resources page. You'll see that's actually hyperlinked on the slide in front of you, and you'll find it under the related URL window to the right side of your screen. I would ask if you can take just a moment to fill out our short feedback form. We do read each and every one of those responses, so if you'd like to continue to see seminars offered on this or other related topics, please share your thoughts with us on the seminar feedback form. If you don't have time to submit that form today, that's okay. The form will be live from this point forward. You can actually fill it out tomorrow or later on in the week if need be. If you're one of the lucky ones replaying the recorded version of today's broadcast, that seminar feedback form is still available and is actually available under the related URL links to the right side. You can click on that and fill it out, even if you're just watching the archive. For those of you that are looking for confirmation of your participation today, we don't necessarily issue CEUs or PDHs for certificate purposes, but you may be able to earn credit anyway. If you keep a copy of the registration email you received when you signed up, you download either the agenda or copies of the materials that were discussed, and you fill out the feedback form, there is a box you can check on that feedback form to request a confirmation email sent to you. As long as your email address is entered correctly, we'll send an email that at least verifies you submitted feedback after the live delivery. So if you kind of couple all of the material together, you may be able to earn credit from your training officer or accrediting institution. Again, thank you all so very much for joining us for today's live broadcast. We hope that it was a valuable experience.